From Brennan to the Boca Chiel, from Lummi to La Push, and from the lordly Sawduck to lovely Duckabush. From Samish to Sammamish, Suquamish to Quilicene, the climate is so friendly, it's a land that's evergreen.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Evergreen State podcast. I'm your host, John C., and thank you for joining me today for episode 108, Mansfield in the Big Bend Country. Before the 1890s, the Big Bend Country was comprised of four counties in central Washington: Lincoln, Franklin, Adams, and Douglas. Waterville was the only town in Douglas County to be platted, and it was designated as the county seat in 1886. In 1889, a group of cattlemen traveled 31 miles northeast of Waterville to establish themselves in the area that would become Mansfield. Henry Gustav Jaeger, who was born in Germany, and his family made their home west of the future town site. Soon after, Valmore E. Calais Sr. and two Marchand families made their own 160-acre homesteads in the surrounding area. Water was brought in from a spring named Alkali Wells, which was about a mile east. The settlers spoke of abundant bunch grass and gushed about the wheatlands, which they described as having warm, dry summers and mild winters. However, the town of Mansfield was merely a dot on the map at the time, and it was not even mentioned in Richard F. Steele's 1904 book, An Illustrated History of the Big Bend Country. Meanwhile, the Great Northern Railway was making its way through the Evergreen State, selling one-way tickets to the west as an inducement for people to board the trains. 10 to 15 homestead seekers arrived by rail in Wenatchee every day, with the majority of them destined for Douglas County. Friends Robert E. Darling and Earl Albert Freeman moved to the area from Mansfield, Ohio in 1900 to start a new life. The same year, widow Lucy Blanche Hatch Lamance and her family relocated to the western United States. She would spend $1,920, $12 an acre, to purchase her 160 acres in the country. A piece of the Lamance's land was purchased by the Great Northern Railway in 1906 for $4,000. It would be this property that would become the site of Mansfield. Darling began homesteading in the southeast corner of town in 1901. Mansfield was established on the 1st of February 1905 when he was selected as the first postmaster for the burgeoning hamlet, which he named after his hometown of Mansfield, Ohio. On the northwest corner of First Street, between Main and Douglas, there was a post office. Darling anticipated that the railroad would eventually make its way to town, allowing the village to thrive and flourish. It didn't take long for reports of abundant harvests to spread like wildfire after the land had been cleared and wheat planted. Douglas County had 96 homesteads listed between 1901 and 1906, according to county records. Early settlers were visited by circuit-riding preachers on horseback who provided spiritual nourishment for the town. Reverend John Alexander Glessner, a 1901 homesteader and Civil War veteran, was well known as a fiery orator who delivered his sermons with fire and brimstone. He and Reverend George Edward Barrows traveled throughout the region, bringing the Bible and preaching the gospel to as many people as possible. Later on, churches played an important role in providing the community with social events, activities, Sunday school, and other forms of assistance and support. Barrows retired from circuit riding in 1909 and moved to Mansfield with his wife, Pauline Barrows, where he erected a Christian church which was dedicated in 1910 and is still in use today. The services had been held on the second floor of the C.H. Knox store up to that point. The construction of St. Mary's Catholic Church began in 1909, and Reverend Ross arrived in 1910 to begin construction on the St. John Lutheran Church by the end of the year. Methodists gathered at the Hamilton Family House on a regular basis, and the Methodist Episcopal Church was completed in 1911, with Reverend B.J. Smith serving as the church's first pastor. By the fall of 1909, there were sufficient numbers of pupils to support the establishment of a school. Blanche Lamance generously contributed an acre of her land, and volunteers worked rapidly to construct a schoolhouse on the site. 6 weeks later, a second one-room schoolhouse was constructed, and Ada Bayer was hired to teach in the new facility. Eunice Thompson Fisher, a county administrator at the time, was hired as the school's principal in 1910. The St. Mary's Catholic Church served as the venue for first and second grade instruction at the time. Reports of a proposed railway connection to Mansfield began to circulate in early 1907. Engineer A.F. Whitcomb expressed his support for the project in a letter to Great Northern's chief engineer, Albert H. Hoagland, sent in 1908. Whitcomb stated, "I believe that the line should be extended to a location near Mansfield." According to him, a large belt of wheat country stretched from the west to the east to the north to the northwest of Mansfield, and virtually all of it was under cultivation. He also mentioned that a general store was located in Mansfield, which was about 2 miles away from the current town of Newark. According to Mr. Whitcomb, Mansfield was a natural trading post, although the majority of the trading took place in Bridgeport and Cooley City because nearly all of the wheat grown in this part of the country was being hauled to these two towns, and unless the line was extended to a point near Mansfield, the wheat growers would continue to haul their wheat to Bridgeport and Cooley City. The line was completed in September of 1909. From the Great Northern's main line in Wenatchee, near the Columbia River, the Great Northern purchased a rail right-of-way and began laying track in January of 1909, starting from the Columbia River. They snaked up Douglas Creek, past the wheat fields of the Waterville Plateau, and into a region near Mansfield, covering a distance of 60.58 miles. The track was completed on the 15th of September 1909, after only 9 months, thanks to the labor of personnel from Cuba, China, Greece, Italy, Germany, and Ireland. During the building period, two station houses were constructed to house foremen and other railroad staff. When it was complete, the new line came to a stop 1.5 miles short of Mansfield's historic town center. Residents subsequently transferred their belongings to the new town site at the end of the line, utilizing horses, lumber, and carts to do so. Many rail employees left after the railway was completed, while others remained and established themselves in the area. The new railroad would have a profound impact on how people lived and how business was conducted. To paraphrase a historical figure, wheat ushered in the railroad constructed the town. The completion of the Mansfield branch line was commemorated on the 9th of October 1909 when the first passenger train, consisting of Albert H. Hoagland's private car Manitoba, engine GNR number 1147, and a caboose made its inaugural journey. In all, there were 10 station stops on the line. Columbia River, also known as Byron, Appledale, which was known as Palisades, McHugh, also known as Allstown, Douglas, Supley, Withrow, and finally Mansfield. The construction of a spur line connecting Waterville and Douglas was completed in 1910. Using 40-foot boxcars, wheat could be transported in 4 hours from Mansfield, a distance of approximately 60 miles. On the 1st of November 1909, the line began full service, bringing grain to the market for the first time. Every day, two trains went, one carrying passengers in the morning and another carrying freight in the afternoon. A roundhouse was constructed in order to service the engines. An impressive total of 405,000 bushels of wheat were hauled out of Mansfield during the first year of operation. Wheat, freight, baggage, mail, and people were all moved by train. The Great Northern expressed confidence in the line's long-term viability, pointing out that Mansfield was a young and expanding town with building taking place all throughout. Two banks, a blacksmith, the Theodore Radke Harness Shop, a post office, two restaurants, two real estate offices, a lodge house, one hotel, two general merchandise stores, one doctor, Elias C. Ute's pool hall, and the Mansfield News, which was published from 1899 until 1922, were all located in Mansfield itself. It was decided to establish a telegraph line at the Mansfield station, which would allow communications to be transmitted between the town and the rest of the globe via a party line. Railroad workers, ranchers, wheat growers, storekeepers, and families with children flocked to the area, and the town flourished swiftly. Mansfield had the appearance of a typical western town, with its wooden buildings and sidewalks, as well as its ornate storefronts, which were all erected near to one another. The Cross Hotel, built by Robert Bob Lee Cross, was perhaps the most notable attraction, along with the construction of the railroad tracks. It provided some of the finest lodgings and dining in north central Washington, and it was a popular tourist destination. Cross, a contractor, and William Alva Havener collaborated on the construction of numerous Mansfield homes that are still occupied to this day. Hundreds of horses, sometimes as many as 20 to a hitch, or mules, or a combination of the two, were used to plow and plant the fields. A large number of harvest crews would pass through the town during the late summer and early fall. Separated chopped grain was loaded into sacks in preparation for transport. Edward V. Cook, the owner of a well in the town, delivered water to the residents beginning in 1910. The town's original wooden grain elevator, built in 1910 near the west end of town, was also a notable landmark. The Farmers Union owned and ran the elevator until 1917, when it was sold to the Waterville Union, which continued to run it until the 1970s. Mansfield was on the verge of becoming a boomtown. Thousands of people rushed to the area, establishing new businesses such as a butcher shop, a dry goods store, pharmacies, a dry goods warehouse, machine operators, undertakers, steam engine machinists, and other enterprises. As more people arrived, additional housing became necessary. By the end of 1910, the town's rapid population growth had qualified it for incorporation as a municipality. According to the 1910 census, Mansfield had a population of 615 people, while Douglas County had a total population of 9,227. The Wright Lumber Company, led by James William Wright, erected an $8,500 school building that first opened its doors in September of 1911. Two rooms were on each floor of the three-story building, with an additional small room on the first floor. The building was constructed of red brick. By the conclusion of 1915, there were 24 high school pupils enrolled. When Henry Greenwood graduated from Mansfield High School in 1917, he earned the distinct honor of being the school's first graduate. The community invested $2.5 million in the 1980s to renovate and modernize the original school. Today, the Mansfield School District educates students from pre-kindergarten through the 12th grade. Mansfield was officially established as a town on the 23rd of February 1911 when the state of Washington incorporated the community. The first town council meeting was conducted on the 3rd of March 1911 in the town hall. Mayor James William Wright presided over the town's first council meeting, which also appointed a municipal clerk, an attorney, a city marshal, and a police justice to serve the community. Mansfield staged its first 4th of July celebration 5 months after its incorporation. People traveled from far and wide to attend the festival. Frank Fred Mankey organized a parade that marched to the music of the Buckingham Band, and the band later performed at Buckingham Hall after the parade. Farmer James Madison Kinney moved to Mansfield from Tennessee in 1902 to start a wheat and cattle ranch. In 1912, he began construction on an elaborate Victorian octagonal house northwest of town as a wedding gift for his daughter, Ruth Mabel Kinney, and son-in-law, David Clyde Gallagher, who had recently married. The construction of the eight-sided mansion was completed in 1914. The home would be officially listed on the National Register of Historic Places in June of 1975, and it was later relocated to a new location. The town received its own water system, which was provided by the Mansfield Water and Light Company on the 13th of July 1913. With a capacity of 750,000 gallons, the water tank was considered extremely large for its day. A peak population of between 1,000 and 1,500 people was reached during this time period in the small town that had been established by hardworking men, women, and children. 1914 proved to be quite the year in terms of fires, which is no surprise to anyone who is familiar with these episodes I do of town histories. From Seattle and Spokane to Wilbur and Mansfield, fire in these early boom towns were quite common and often gave the people of the towns a chance to improve their community just a little bit. Turning a negative into a positive is something we're quite good at here in the Evergreen State. During a fire on New Year's Day of 1914, the Scully Company store, which was the town's first wooden structure, was completely destroyed. Damage in other areas was kept to a minimum thanks to the efforts of volunteer firefighters. By June of 1914, Mansfield had rebounded swiftly and had transformed from an agricultural attraction into a destination, attracting visitors from all throughout the central Evergreen State and beyond. The town's official photographer, W. Alexander, relocated to Mansfield from Wilbur in Lincoln County when the town was founded. Alexander constructed a residence on the land that is today known as Harry Beard Park. On the 3rd of July 1914, the town was jolted awake by the sound and smell of another fire in the early hours of the morning. The two-story C.H. Knox store, formerly known as Mansfield's Greatest Store, had exploded in flames and had been completely consumed by the fire by the time the town folk realized what was going on. Towards the end of the day, heavy gusts had carried the flames over both sides of the first block of Main Street in downtown, causing extensive damage. Clifford H. Knox, the owner of a convenience store in Mansfield, was one of the few who did not rebuild or choose to remain in the city. The railroad depot, post office, and hotel were all saved thanks to the efforts of volunteer firefighters. Holy smokes, 4 months later, in November of 1914, yet another fire broke out, this time on the west side of town, demolishing the second block of Main Street. That's the third fire in under a year's time for any of you keeping track out there. Following the disastrous fires of 1914, the town council enacted an ordinance mandating all buildings to be constructed of fireproof materials and barring the use and erection of wooden sidewalks, among numerous other requirements. New buildings were constructed in a short period of time. Mansfield rose to its feet and continued on its path. The first Ford Model T, which was employed to convey mail between the Del Rio and Bridgeport districts, was delivered in 1914. The wheat industry continues to be the engine of the country's economy. It was predicted that Mansfield would ship 600,000 bushels of wheat in 1916, accounting for approximately half of the crop for the year. At $2 a bushel, it represented a significant amount of money for the local economy. A total of more than $3.7 million in monetary transactions were processed via the Mansfield State Bank in that year. It was decided to establish a second bank, the Commercial Bank, which was quickly acquired by the Mansfield State Bank. This was also the year when Christian Friedrich Wilhelm Duchy Schmidt constructed Mansfield's first concrete grain elevator. The following was written about the town in the 1916-1917 edition of R.L. Polk & Company's Directory. Mansfield is strategically located in the center of the state's wheat-producing region, a nice brick public school with 5 instructors, which provides instruction to 150 students during the school year, is located in Mansfield. Methodist, Catholic, Christian, and German Lutheran are the 4 denominations represented. There are 2 first-class hotels to accommodate the traveling public, while 5 well-equipped general stores, 1 clothing store, 3 hardware stores, 2 lumber companies, 3 implement dealers, 2 blacksmiths and wagon makers, 2 livery barns, both of which provide auto service, 1 drugstore, a meat market, a harness maker, 1 stationery and bookstore, a cigar maker, and a ready cash market for eggs serve the mercantile needs of the community. 3 physicians and surgeons, 2 lawyers, and 1 dentist are among the professions represented on the panel. The Mansfield Office of the United States Postal Service has just been designated as a postal savings bank, with the Mansfield State Bank serving as the depository. The Mansfield Commercial Club was founded in January of 1917 by a group of 90 business owners who came together to form a cooperative effort. The shacks of the homesteaders who built in the Mansfield country only 10 to 15 years ago are rapidly giving way to the substantial farm buildings of a prosperous country, the Wenatchee Daily World reported on the 31st of January 1917. The newspaper continued, "Today, Mansfield is one of the truly substantially built towns of the north central Washington country." The town was ecstatic as a result of all its success. The Blue Stem Lane celebration, which took place from the 2nd to the 4th of July 1917, was a 3-day event. A blanket of wheat was spread across the streets of Wenatchee to draw attention to the celebrations, which was organized by the merchants of Mansfield to help publicize the event. It was quite successful, with a parade with bands and floats, a rodeo, a carnival, sideshows, and dancing in the pavilion were all part of the celebrations. The Mansfield News stated that there were 31 functional and thriving businesses in the town of Mansfield. When the fall of 1917 arrived, there was minimal rainfall, resulting in drought conditions and poor crop production. Towards the end of the First World War, in October 1918, grain from Europe flooded the market, causing the price of wheat to collapse from $3.50 a bushel to less than a penny per pound in a matter of months. There was an abundance of wheat, but there was simply no market for it to be had anywhere. Residents of Mansfield moved elsewhere in search of better possibilities. When the population fell to 478 people in 1920, attempts were made to attract new residents to the area. In 1921, the Great Northern published a guidebook with information for anyone looking for a place to live and touted Mansfield as one of those opportunities. Cheap land, bright futures in Douglas County, and long-term opportunities are all mentioned, as is the availability of decent agriculture among good individuals. Due to the fact that many of the previous farmers were heavily in debt and unable to make payments on their loans to banks or insurance companies, land was very inexpensive. In Mansfield, on the 30th of November 1921, sisters Pearl May Cross Bellis and Mary L. Cross Wand, who worked as cook wagon drivers during the wheat harvest, put their hard-earned money in the City Savings and Loan Association. It was on that same day that a rancher arrived in town to deposit a $1,000 check. The bank had already closed for the day, yet they nevertheless took his check. The following day, on the 1st of December 1921, the two sisters and the rancher lost all that they had worked so hard for. The bank in Mansfield was forced to close its doors, never to reopen, dealing another significant blow for the community, and also explaining why they so easily took the man's check and then closed the next day. Farmers, on the other hand, found themselves with an excess of wheat and no profitable markets to sell it to. Because they had debts on it, or because transportation was unavailable, they had to hold the 1921 crop in a warehouse. According to a newspaper article published in December of 1921, the railroad reduced its schedule from 5 trains per week to 2 or 3 runs a week. According to trainmen who worked in the area at the time, the trains would only make 3 journeys per week between there and Wenatchee beginning next Monday, with the crew spending Sunday in Wenatchee and making the down trip from there on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. While there were probably 1,000 vehicle loads of wheat to be removed, there was little movement at the moment, and extras were utilized to transport the wheat when it was ready for shipping. While they were disappointed by this development, they had to make the best of the situation until they felt they were back on the map. 6 months later, on the 18th of July 1922, in the middle of a Tuesday afternoon, the town of Mansfield was devastated by yet another terrible fire. The fire broke out in the OK Livery Barn, where it spread quickly. Among the buildings destroyed by the fire were Harold Johansson's Machine and Blacksmith Shop, four homes, the Fraternal Building, which was home to Glenn Brett's Barber Shop, and Theodore W. Radke's Harness Shop, the Theater, the Old City and Lehigh Hotels, an attorney's office, a doctor's office, the Mansfield News, and the Luxury Cross Hotel. The exact cause of the fire was never determined. Mansfield did not heal as quickly as it had in the past. Businesses shuttered their doors. Many of the residents left, never to return again. In the mid-1930s, mechanization began to be used on farms. Farmers integrated their operations when tractor-towed combine pulling was phased out and trucks transformed the way freight was handled. In 1944, the first wheat fire alarm system was established. Mansfield International Airport first opened its doors in April of 1950. Today, the airport is one of numerous locations in the state where a pilot can land and then walk to a neighboring restaurant for a bite to eat after landing. It's this reason why Mansfield is mentioned in the book The $100 Hamburger. In 1950, a paved road was constructed connecting Mansfield with the towns of Withrow and Farmer. In 1964, the highway was renamed State Route 172. It runs for 3 blocks through the heart of Mansfield's Main Street. The Great Northern Railroad and the Burlington Northern Railroad combined in 1970 to form the Burlington Northern. The Mansfield branch line was decommissioned for the final time on the 12th of March 1985, after 75 years of operation. The rails had suffered significant deterioration and were unable to support the newer, heavier hopper cars. The rails were removed from the ground by 1986. In June of 2009, the town of Mansfield celebrated its centennial. It was reported in the Quad City Herald that Mansfield refers to itself as the town at the end of the rails, despite the fact that the railroad tracks have been gone for over a quarter century. Though the description of the town today is a little inaccurate, the railroad is responsible for the existence of Mansfield. The Mansfield Museum and Historical Society began a program in 2011 to gather and preserve the town's history, with the goal of making it accessible to anybody who might be interested. Mansfield is still mostly an agricultural town with a population of approximately 345 people, 250 of whom live in town and the remaining living on outlying farms. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star review and don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss a new episode. Doing so really helps the show to grow and to expand to a new audience, so any help that you can give in that regard will be greatly appreciated. Sources for this episode include The $100 Hamburger, A Guide to Pilots' Favorite Fly-In Restaurants by John F. Perner, An Illustrated History of the Big Bend Country Embracing Lincoln, Douglas, Adams, and Franklin Counties by Richard F. Steele, Mansfield, The Town at the End of the Rails by Marjorie Patty McGrath and Helen Weeks at HistoryLink.org, the U.S. Census Bureau website, the Quad City Herald, the Seattle Times, the Great Northern Railway Historical Society, and Washington Rural Heritage. Thank you for listening to episode 108, Mansfield in the Big Bend Country. Episode 109 will be released next week. A special thank you goes out to Al Hirsch for providing the music for the podcast. If you have any questions about the show, please contact historyoftheevergreenstatepod@gmail.com. Thank you once again for listening to another episode of the History of the Evergreen State podcast and for continuing to listen. I've been doing this show weekly now for almost 2 years, and the continued support you all provide me makes this quite a fun and fulfilling hobby. And until next time, I'm your host, John C.
There's peace on the Skokomish, on the Queets, and on the Ho. There's calm on the Nisqually, born of ageless ice and snow. A land that nature loves so much, she stays the whole year round. I trade a royal palace for a shack on Puget Sound. There's Chimicum and Stillicum, where spouts the gooey duck, the singing Stillaguamish and the swirling Skookumchuck, and Moclips and Copalis, where the razor clams abound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound.